with Lowercase Neal, and the interview is taking place at his home at 100 Marble Street in Ishpeming, Michigan, and the date is April 5th, 1994. The interviewer is myself, Mary Andes, and you'll hear me refer to Mr. Smale as Uncle Low, and there's a real good reason for that. It's because he is my uncle. All right.
Lowercase Neal, born in Nagani on January 21st, 1923.
And the names of your parents and their occupations?
My father's name was William Chapman Smale, and he was a telegrapher for the railroad. And my mother was Clara Ann Pennyhill before she got married. And she was a housewife.
All right. Next, let's talk about where you went to high school, the year that you graduated, and what you did after high school, which I presume was military service.
Well, I never did graduate. I never did go to high school. So, just went to work after grade school.
Now, when you went to work after grade school, what work was that, and how old were you?
16, and was a bellhop at the hotel in Nagani.
Which hotel was that?
The Breiding Hotel. I was bellhop and boilerman. I had to take care of the furnace at night.
Now, was there a reason why you started working when you were 16? Was it your choice or was it necessity for the family?
No, it's just that I thought I knew everything there was to know.
And I see that hasn't changed, right?
Right.
Okay. All right, you were 16 when you started at the Breiding.
Yeah.
And then after that, what? And when?
Well, worked there about a year, and then I went odd jobs, worked for the railroad for a few years, a few summers, then worked on WPA for a while. Wasn't supposed to, but I was driving truck for my brother. He owned a truck, so they hired the truck, and I was the driver.
Why was it that you weren't supposed to do that?
Well, that was for older people, so I was only about 18 at the most. So.
Able?
Hmm? Able? Well, that was later. Worked for Abe Wolf later on.
Who?
Trapper and stuff.
Who was Abe Wolf?
He was a junk dealer, you might say. He picked up different metals, and then he went into car business, fruit business.
Okay, so he's somebody that's probably fairly well known in Nagani that people can place him. After you worked for Abe Wolf, then what?
Well, let's see. Worked for the city of Nagani for a year, doing odd jobs and that. Then I went to Detroit in the early 40s to work at the bomber plant.
Ypsilanti,
yes. Okay.
Okay. You did that for how long?
Boy, sir, about roughly 2 years. Then my number came up to go in the Army, so I went in the Army.
Okay. And how old were you when you went into the Army?
About 21.
And where did marriage fit into all of this?
Well, I was married before I went into the Army. Got married roughly... first year I was in Ypsilanti. So.
And can you give me the date of your marriage and your wife's maiden name?
1942, I was married. And my wife's name was Don Tippett Smale. There is no.
Okay, fair enough.
November 25.
November 25, yeah.
All right. All right. I guess I'd like to skip over military service.
Okay.
Because that's a whole other story. And when you left the military, what year was that, and what did you do at the time you left the military?
I was discharged in 1945, and it took me almost a year to get a job in the mines.
Why did it take so long?
Well, they weren't hiring too many then.
Now, just briefly, can you tell me what you did for a living in between the time you left the service and the time you got in at the mine?
Well, they gave us unemployment for so many weeks after we got out of service. And I also worked in the woods for Joe Erickson, cutting pulp.
Okay. Joe Erickson?
Joe Erickson.
Okay. Okay, and that was in the Ishpeming Nagani area?
Yes.
Okay, then, when you did get hired at the mine, what year was that, and what type of job were you hired for?
1947, and I was hired as a common laborer to begin with.
Okay, now do you remember what kinds of things that you were told at the time you were hired to orient you into what your job was going to be, and what did they tell you about what to wear? And this was, I presume, underground. I'd like to also know what mine it was.
Well, it was an array, and really, they didn't tell us what we had to wear. You found that out from the other miners. But you had to have rubber boots and heavy clothes, because it's cold down there.
How cold?
Oh, some places in the 40s and some places a little warmer. But it was same temperature all year long, you might say. Different spots were hotter, but the reason it was hotter was the poor air circulation, I think.
Do you remember it being really humid or stuffy underground at all?
Not really. It was pretty good air most of the time.
Did you have any special clothing other than the rubber boots and having something warm? Did you have to wear hearing protection, respirators, anything like that?
No. Well, I had hats and our lights.
Of the equipment that you had to have, your hard hat and your lights, did you have to purchase that yourself, or did the mine provide that for you?
The company provided it.
If you can think for a minute about the very first day that you went to work in a mine, did you have any special recollections of what that was like, or what your thoughts were before you actually started work on your first day? Any new job has a little anxiety and a little butterflies in the stomach and that kind of thing. And I just wondered if there was anything in particular that you remembered about the ride down in the cage, or what the other men were like.
Well, the ride down in the cage was scary the first time, because it just as though they cut the floor off from under you and down you went. But once you got used to riding in a cage, it was good, but the first time was kind of scary.
Do you have any idea like how fast the cage went down?
I said no. I ended up being an engineer in the engine house. I think it was 1,700 feet a minute.
Does that leave you with a butterfly feeling in your stomach?
Mm-hmm.
Now, can you describe the cage a little bit and how many people it could hold at one time?
Well, it's roughly 8 feet square, and there's two decks on it. Altogether, it's about 20 feet high. The deck itself is only 8, and then you got about 6 feet maybe that comes to a point at the top. But it was safe enough in there.
Why is it called a cage?
I have no idea.
Was it all enclosed on the outside, or was it made of bars?
All enclosed metal, and then sliding door on each end.
So it kind of felt like an elevator?
Yes, like an elevator.
Okay.
Only there was no lights in there. It was pitch dark. If you turn your headlight off, it was pitch dark in there.
Okay, and you might have answered this question already, but how many men at a time would go down in the cage?
Oh, altogether, I'd say 30 men to the deck, and there was two decks, so you got 60 men.
Okay. Now, the process when you would get to work was what?
You go in the dry building, clean clothes first, take your clean clothes off, then you go from the clean clothes dry into the dirty clothes dry, and you put your dirty clothes on. Your winter underwear and your overalls and your boots, hard hat, belt.
How many layers of clothes would you have altogether?
Well, I generally only wore long underwear and a pair of overalls.
Now, when you say changing from clean clothes to dirty clothes, describe why you were calling the dirty clothes the dirty clothes.
Well, they were covered with iron ore dust and that, so they were dirty. You wouldn't want to wear them home, that's for sure.
And what color?
Red. When you brought them home every 2 weeks, maybe, or every week to wash them, the washing machine would turn red.
I bet they smelled real good too, huh?
Well, pretty good.
Okay. All right, well, we had tape stopped. We started talking about some of the horseplay that happens on the cage.
Okay, there was one fellow, he was kind of dirty. Especially if you're a new man, he'd get up behind you and pee down your pants leg. Of course, he got a couple kicks every now and then, but he still kept it up to his old age. I don't know how he lived to be old. But that was one of his dirty tricks.
Did he do this to every new employee?
Well, everyone he could get to do it.
So it didn't matter how long you had been there, he would do it anyway, right?
Right, he'd try to get you.
Is that your baptism?
Then you kick each other in the legs and flip your hats off on purpose, you know. Sometimes they even knock them off and they go down the shaft. They fall out the door and down the shaft they go.
What would happen if somebody did lose their hat down the shaft like that? Would you have to pay to replace your own hat, or would the company replace it, or how was that done?
You'd have to pay to replace your own hat.
And how much did that cost?
$250, if I remember right.
Do you have any other recollections of silliness that would go on in the dry, or in the ride down, or lunchtime, or any of the funny nicknames that people had for each other, or things along of that nature?
Well, in the dry, sometimes in the shower room, they'd turn the hot water off on you if you weren't watching them close, because that was one of their games. Or steal your soap, and then you'd have to try to wash without soap.
Anybody ever steal your clothes?
No, they were pretty good about clothes, see? Because if you got caught, then you were in trouble.
What kind of trouble?
Well, you could get fired for stealing somebody's clothes, even though it was a joke.
You ever know of anybody that happened to without mentioning any names?
No, I don't.
Let's get back to the first job that you started with. You said it was as a laborer, and can you describe that a little bit for me?
Well, when I got down on the level, the boss told me to go in the drift, and there was a car in there to start mucking the ditch. When you're working in the mine like that, there's a certain percentage of the water coming down carries ore with it, and it'd start piling up in the ditches. So we had to go in and muck out the ditches by hand, throw them in these cars.
Okay, when you say mucking out the ditch, you had to shovel the muck out?
Shovel it out, and it was sticky. It would stick to your shovel, it would stick to your boots, it would stick all over.
So there was a little oily consistency to that, too, as well as being sticky. And
right,
bitter.
There is.
Now, when you had to muck out the ditch, you would do this for the whole eight-hour shift?
Whole eight-hour shift. Day in, day out, until you got promoted, you might say.
And how long would it usually take before you got promoted?
Well, month, maybe, a couple weeks. All depends how short-handed they were.
Now, during the course of a workday like that, when you were mucking the ditch, how much of a break would you get, like a bathroom break or a lunch break or something like that?
Well, you had 20 minutes for lunch. That's the only real break you got. Otherwise, you kept steady at it so you could show progress, you might say.
And then how many people did you have that you worked with in your immediate area doing this?
Most of the time, four of us worked together. So
you got to know those four people pretty well then?
Yes, because and then sometimes they'd switch crews. They'd take one man away and give him another job for a day or two, and then he'd come back, and then maybe they'd give somebody else a job. They switch around quite a bit.
So that you got a little bit of relief from shoveling. Okay. Then after you got through mucking the ditches, then what did you do next?
Next, they put us on midnight shift hoisting timber. They hoist the wagon up, and the timber sets up to the where the miners are drifting, and all your lagging and whatever they needed.
Can you describe what lagging is?
Lagging is a cedar split, so it's about 3 inches in diameter.
And is that put in as like a support for the...
That's put in like a cushion, so when the ore comes down, it compresses a little bit without breaking. Maybe they'll put 2 feet behind the set, and as it comes down, it compresses down quite a bit.
The wood compresses down?
Yes.
All right. When you were doing the work with the timbers, again, how many people would there be in a crew, and would you have to go a long distance from one point to another to transport the wood?
Most of the time there was 3 or 4 of us on a crew, and we'd go in. The motorman would bring the timber trucks in, and we'd go to different spots in the drift and hoist it up to the different mining crews up above. Sometimes you had to hoist it up 200 feet. Maybe you were lucky. Some nights you'd only have to hoist it up to a couple of 50-footers. But it was work. You had to keep busy to get your allotted hoisting done.
So they would have a set amount of timber for you to hoist?
Yes, they'd give us maybe 15 trucks of stuff to hoist in the night.
Now, can you describe how long the timbers were, how heavy they were?
Well, the big timbers were hardwood, generally maple, some birch, but they were... The majority were 9 feet long, and then the cap was 12 feet long. And they were at least a foot in diameter.
You said you had to do 15 trucks. Can you describe what the truck looked like? Was that a train car more than a truck?
It was a little flat car with the four wheels and posts on the side to hold the timbers on. The engine, or the motorman, pushed them in for us. They were hooked together with a little chain, so.
And then what was used to hoist the timbers up?
An air tugger with a big steel cable, at least a half-inch cable. They put that down the braze, and they called it the timber road. It was just let's see, a 4x4 raise going up, and we use that just for hoisting timber. The men didn't travel in that section. So, because sometimes the timber gets stuck and then you'd have to go up the ladder road and bar them over. Sometimes they'd fall down again on the track and you'd have to start all over. But most of the time it would work pretty good.
And so the timber road was not used for shoveling ore back down either. It was just used for timber?
Just used for timber.
There was another word that you used when you're talking about sliding the wood over. And I can't remember what that word is. Hang on just a second. Okay, the word that we wanted to get a little definition on is barring them over.
Well, you'd have a long bar about 6-8 feet long, and in between the timbers on the timber road, there's a space maybe 2 inches, 3 inches. You put your bar in there and get the timbers to move, and they'd either go up or they'd fall down again.
Now, I saw you doing me a little gesture with your hands there that we can't see on the tape. When the timbers were put on the cars, were there spacers in between so that you could get them off there more easily?
Sometimes they were put pretty close together. You had to bar them a little bit to get our cable hooked onto them.
Okay. So barring it was kind of like using a lever?
Yes, like a wrecking bar.
Okay. So then you went from mucking to doing timber, and basically that involved delivering the timber into the raises?
The raises and the drifts where the miners were working.
And what would the miners use the wood for?
To hold the back up, or to hold the ore up, as you might say. If you don't know what the back was, it's the roof of the drift.
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask you, was to define what the back is.
Okay.
Then after you did that job, you would have done that for about how long? I mean, was it months or years?
Oh, I'd say I was on that about 6 months.
And then what after that?
Well, then I went with off and on with some of the miners. If one of the miners were home, they'd take one of us and put in with a miner for a day or two.
So that was how you learned what the miners did?
Yes.
And then can you describe that, what the person with the job description of miner did?
Okay. We start off, we got a straight face in there, say, in the morning. We go in.
Wait a second, I want to stop you for a second and tell me what a straight face is.
Okay, that's the end of the drift.
Okay.
Okay, and then we go in and we drill. And then we'd put the dynamite in to blast, get all set to blast. Generally, they blasted around dinner time.
Why was that?
Well, so the smoke would clear out while we're eating. Then after the smoke cleared out and we got through eating, we go back in and scrape that dirt out. And then when we got it all cleaned out, we put the set up again, the two legs of timber and then the top timber. And put the wagon behind the sets and start all over again. Drill again and blast, scrape it out.
When you say scrape the dirt out, you mean scrape the ore out?
Well, sometimes it was rock. Sometimes we worked in rock, too. So it all depends what we're in, ore or rock.
Can you describe what was used to do the scraping?
That's going to be a hard scraping. It's like a teaspoon with bent at a right angle, only most of them were 4 feet wide, 2 feet high, and the arms came out to a point in the front. And we had a cable hooked on the front and a cable hooked down in the back to pull it back in and then pull it out.
So maybe you might say that it's like a triangular shaped device that has like a blade.
Right.
On the back end of it, so it was being towed, and that flat blade came
right
with the ore.
Yeah.
Okay. What is a set?
A set is a set of timber. Two legs, they call them, and then a cap on top. Sometimes it took 8-10 men to put the calf up, because they were generally pretty heavy and had to be pretty strong to hold that, the back up, the roof up.
And that was all done by hand? Did they have jacks or anything like that to put
all done by hand.
So was the cross piece put up first and then the supports?
No, the two legs were put up first, and then we made like a staging across so you could stand on that and lift your cap up. You know, some of them caps, they took all you had.
So that when the cap was put on, you were literally pushing up against the ore body?
Just about, yes. Maple. Big maple and birch logs.
I think we talked about the size of those, but can you reiterate the size, the diameter, and the length?
Well, most of the caps were roughly 12 feet long, and anywhere from 18 to 26 inches in diameter.
So then, as I understand the process, it would be, you would have basically a fresh face of ore that would be set with charges and blasted and lifted out, and then some supports put up again, and then the process would repeat.
Yes, that would be about it. Unless when you blasted, somebody didn't watch too close, and they blasted four or five sets on it when you put the charge up. That was very bad.
Why was that very bad?
Well, then you had to go in and put all the sets back up. You had to clean your way in again and put a set up and clean your way in and put a set up. It didn't happen too often because you didn't make no money when that happened. You just got company count.
What is company count?
Well, they pay you so much a foot, whether you get anything done or not, they just go by the footage. So when you were getting paid by the foot, you wanted to get lots done.
So you got paid a basic hourly wage and then a footage rate besides?
Yes.
So then with the sets being those sets of timbers, if you blasted out five sets of timbers, you lost quite a bit of yardage, didn't you?
You did. You lost quite a bit of money.
What would you guesstimate was the distance between the sets?
I'd say 8 feet.
Would you be willing to say, give us an approximate figure on what the hourly wage would be when you first started as a laborer, then when you were doing the timbers, then when you became a miner, and then what that bonus would have been, the distance bonus that you would have gotten?
Well, it wouldn't be accurate because it's too long ago, but I think when I first started, I started about 2-something an hour. Then I gradually worked up. Timber hoisting was a little more, that, say, 275 an hour. Then mining, you made, that was quite a bit more. That, I'd say $5 an hour.
And then what would the additional rate be then if you for the distance, and what did you call that?
Footage.
What was the footage rate? Can you remember it all?
No, I can't.
And who accounted for the footage? Was that the shift boss's responsibility?
The shift boss came in and measured every day.
So then you wanted to really put some pressure on your coworkers to do a good job.
Produce.
Was there a real strong sense of teamwork among the men underground?
Oh, yes. Each bunch of men wanted to keep their end of the cycle up. Sometimes you got a partner that didn't want to work very good, but the majority of the men worked together. And the harder you worked, the more money you made. That's what it boils down to.
Did they ever try to set quotas or little competitions or anything like that?
Or they tried sometimes, like the opposite crew would say, well, we made 8 feet today and got it all drilled for you. Now see what you can do. Uh-huh. So they, like that, they kept going. They kept working.
Was 8 feet considered a pretty good day's work, or what was the benchmark for that?
I'd say 8 feet was a good day's work. Like sometimes you ran into hard ore or hard rock, it took you longer to drill, and maybe the blast didn't clean it out like it should.
We're going to stop tape here and turn over to the other side. Good footage for a day's work. Is there anything else that you can add about mining, the task of a miner, that you think you might have not thought about yet?
Well, sometimes they had it rough, you know. The set would come down, or the back would cave in. In other words, the roof would come down unexpectedly. You'd have to clean that out again and re-put new poles up above the set and fill that space up with wood so to hold the back up.
So then sometimes if there was a soft ceiling, then you would end up putting like a wood ceiling in?
You got the nail on the head right there. You'd put a lot of lag. First you'd put poles up there, and then you put lagging up on top of them, and then keep putting up as much as you can. So the dirt, when it did fall, you could only fall maybe 8 inches, 10 inches, and the cedar would take care of it.
Was there very much of the area that you worked in that needed to have reinforcement and to keep the back up like that?
Not where I work personally, no.
Okay, let's talk about lunch. What did you typically have for lunch, and how did you carry it into work with you?
Well, I carried my steel dinner pail with a thermos bottle in it.
Can you describe your steel dinner pail? What kind of shape was it, approximately?
Well, it's a foot long, roughly, 4 inches wide, 8 inches high. It had a thermos bottle in there. It had generally carried two sandwiches, a piece of fruit, and a piece of Twinkie or something on that order.
Something sweet. Twinkie. And then was it pretty much rectangular in shape, or did it have a little kind of a tunnel-type shape on the top to accommodate the thermos?
It was a little round on the top, yes, to hold the thermos up there.
So it was almost like the shape of a cylinder on top of a rectangle?
Yes.
Only with the sides smoothed out.
All right.
Was this the type of lunch pail that everybody had, and were there any restrictions that you had on the size of your dinner pail based on what your job was or carrying it down in the cage or anything like that?
No, you could carry whatever you wanted to carry your food, and some people only carried paper bags. Some people didn't even take a lunch. You got in the habit of not eating when they were working, so they didn't bother taking lunch.
Well, then, when it got to be time for the dinner break or the lunch break, did you just kind of sit down in the tunnel, or where did you have lunch?
Generally by the tugger. That's a machinery that pulled the scraper in and out. We generally had poles or something there dry to sit on, and maybe the miners on the next drift that come over, and we'd all eat in that one spot. Sometimes you ate alone, because if you were scraping dirt, nobody else was around, you sat and ate, and it was time.
So there's usually a set time for the lunch break?
Pardon?
There was a set time for the lunch break?
No, generally, when you were mining, you got so far in, and if you were all set to blast, and you blasted, then you're going to eat.
So the job sometimes dictated when you would have your lunchtime.
Right. You go according to the job.
Now, when a group of guys would sit down and have lunch together, were there typical topics of conversation?
Well, not so much. Mostly about the work and stuff like that.
Did you have a chance to get to know many of your co-workers that might have been working in nearby sections?
Sometimes, yes. We'd go and visit, you know, lunchtime, or they'd come over, and you get to know them.
Okay, I'm going to ask you another question I've been just dying to know the answer to. Where did you go to the bathroom underground?
Just about anywhere as you felt like. No, they had the honey boxes every so often. But they were the stinkiest thing going, boy.
Honey
boxes? Yeah, that's what they call them. Then they had guys, that's all they did was go down different levels and pick these boxes up and send them up the surface, and they'd clean them out and send them down again.
Can you describe what a honey box looked like?
Well, it's a box about 2.5 feet square with a board across the top for you to sit on. And that was it.
It wasn't even a one hole, was it?
Well, it was one hole, but a big hole.
Okay.
And you didn't bring your own toilet paper. And there was very little there.
I think we'll just let that comment go.
Yeah. No, it was wooden box.
Okay.
Sometimes it did.
I want to backtrack just a little bit, too. When you mentioned lunch break, you said you would find a place to sit down, and if there was a log or something by the tugger, it was a dry spot where it was the bottom of the shaft and everything, not the shaft, but the... Help me out, the passageway?
The floor of the drip.
Okay.
So.
Was it wet?
Well, sometimes you had a wet spot and you had to really look for a dry place to sit to eat.
So was it kind of the nature of the Mather A that the ore was a little bit soft and sometimes it was a little dampish and a little cool, that was just general working conditions?
Yes, that'd be about it.
Do you remember... having to pay any particular attention to noise and stuff with blasting, was that a concern to the miners at all?
Not when we worked. You just blasted, you know. Mm-hmm. Nowadays they won't allow that.
Right.
You got to have your earplugs in and so far away from it.
Sure. Do you remember when you were doing mining and did you personally set charges or was there a regular blasting crew that did that?
The regular miners did it, but I never did it because I helped charge, but the more qualified man, he'd have the lighting of the fuses, because he'd cut certain lengths, and then he'd light them all, and then you'd get out.
Can you describe, like, from the beginning of drilling a hole to the blast itself and how that whole process went?
Well, you went in with a... If you're drilling an ore, you went in with a drive machine and you drilled your hole into the ore.
And how deep would the hole be?
Roughly 8 feet. You'd start off with a 2-foot rod and then a 4-foot rod and then you put your 8-foot rod in.
So was this like a big drill bit when you say
rod? Yeah, just like a big drill bit. And let's see.
And the diameter of the bit would have been what?
Diameter of the bit would be approximately 2 inches. And you'd put roughly 30 holes, I'd say, if it was ore.
About how far apart?
Roughly 2 feet.
So you created kind of a grid?
Yes.
It's 2 foot space?
Yes. The head miner, he was more experienced. He'd tell us where to put the holes and that drillman.
So then after the holes were drilled, then what?
Then you get a wooden stick and help the miner. He'd put the fuse and the cap in one stick, and you push that way in. You mark the stick and pull it out. Then maybe you put 3 sticks in and push them in until you got the hole almost filled to the end.
When you said mark the stick and pull it out, what does that mean?
Well, you hold on to the stick after how far you got it in, so you know you were in all the way with your powder.
I see, okay.
Because sometimes the powder would stick, and then it would break, and then you'd have a heck of a job getting it in again.
So then then you would put sticks of dynamite in?
Yes, sticks of dynamite. Inch and a half, I think they were in diameter, and 8 inches long.
So then how many sticks would fill a hole?
Roughly 8. Then on the end you'd tamp some sand, or we call it sand, but it would be ore or rock. Because if you didn't, sometimes they'd blow right out the hole. They wouldn't break the dirt. But if you put the dirt in and tamp it tight, then it'd make the concussion go inwards.
That makes sense. And then there'd be the fuse. The fuse would come out from
right
where you tamp the dirt in. Was there, like, some of the old mining shows that I've seen, you hear people say fire in the hole. Did they say that when they would ignite the dynamite or when you had...
Yes, when we lit the fuse, we'd holler, fire in the hole. Well, just before we even lit, we went around and told the miners that were closer to us that we were going to blast at a certain time. And then when we lit the fuse, then we'd holler, fire in the hole.
And then you would tell the miners within approximately how close to where you were setting charges?
Roughly 100 feet.
So then would they be within earshot when you said fire in the hole, and then they would stay where they were, or would they go someplace else?
They'd stay where they were.
And then you'd have to be how far away from the blast when it went off?
Oh, sometime 100 feet roughly.
And then... would there be like dust and debris and things like that?
Oh yeah, there'd be a lot of dust and a lot of smoke from the powder.
And then you mentioned that people would have their dinner during the time that was clearing, so that was about 20 minutes for the smoke?
Roughly 20 minutes. Sometimes if the smoke and that didn't get out in time, then you'd take an air hose and put it in there and blow the smoke around. Then it'd eventually go out.
What were the air hoses used for other than blowing the smoke out after a blast?
Well, for your drill machine, they were air operated.
Oh, okay. Did you ever have occasion to use a drilling machine?
Yes, I used a drilling machine.
And was that used for drilling the holes for the charges?
Yeah.
And so that would have been forced air, electrically powered?
Forced air. Pumped on from the surface.
All right, let's see. Do you think we've covered everything about the mining part of the job that you did underground? Is there anything else you'd like to add to that?
Well, there's one day they put me with a miner. They call him a long hole driller. And I was going to be his partner for the day. And he took me in a place that I never knew existed in the mine. It was a dog drift. And a dog drift is almost like it means just room for a dog to go through. It was maybe 2 feet wide, 18 inches wide. It varied maybe 3 feet high all the way in. And you'd crawl in a couple hundred feet like that. And then there's kind of a bigger opening on the end, and then he'd drill long holes, maybe 50, 60 feet, and then they'd charge them and blast them. I never got in on the blasting on that, but I got in on some of the drilling with them, but I didn't like that in there. That was too close.
What did that feel like, having to go 200 feet in a space that was just big enough for your body to go through?
It was scary a little bit, you know, because when you're used to 8 feet square, maybe 9 feet square drift, then go into this little place, you didn't know what was at the end, the first time especially. So.
How many times did you have to do that?
I only worked in there 3 days. And that was enough. I was glad to get out of there.
Do you think that that it was pretty typical for this more experienced guy to just take somebody in there 2 or 3 times because that was about all that they could take of it, do you think?
No, generally they had a regular crew that did this, but this day, or for a couple of days, his partner was off sick, so they left me going there, but we got our work done, but it was fun in a way, but it was scary.
Do you think maybe the knowing that you didn't have to do it all the time made it a little more fun?
Yes.
Any other things along that line, like when you mentioned when you were doing the timber job earlier, did you ever find that you were feeling a little precarious when you were doing climbing and stuff like that? Did they have like wooden ladders to climb or what?
Well, the only other time that I was scared, one of the main drifts on fifth level, in fact, we went in to get some ore and part of the side of the drift was gone. We noticed it was gone, so we pulled the train out. We went back in with our lights and we shined them in there, and there was a big hole there in the plate. The hole, you could never see the top anymore, no matter how powerful the light they brought down, so it must have went up 500 feet at least. Then it went down maybe 200 feet. So there you got a hole in the matter either, that I know of, 700 feet high, you might say. Of course, it's full of water now, but...
What would have accounted for the hole? Was it a sudden cave-in or what?
No, they figured when they were taking oil out of the bottom, they figured it was coming from somewhere else, but it had shifted over and was coming from this particular spot. And then finally it broke through the side of the drift there, and that's how they noticed where they were. Even the engineers didn't know where they were.
So that's one of those once-in-a-lifetime things that you just happen to be close enough to witness.
Witness, right.
Yeah. Was it the hole in the drift, was it real close to where the cars were? Where
it
the,
was right beside the track, maybe 6 feet off of the track.
So it was pretty fortunate then that you guys were close enough that you could pull the cars and everything. Was there, in your opinion, was there, was it kind of a fortunate thing? Would the cars have been at risk for going down into the hole too?
No, they wouldn't have went down, but you never knew how far that hole would cave over afterwards.
I see.
So once they knew about it, then they cut that drift off. They blocked it off.
Do you have any idea approximately what year that would have been?
56, 57, somewhere in there.
Okay, let's go on to after you worked as a miner, and this would have been, you had worked in the mine how long when you were done as a miner and went on to the next job?
Maybe a year. And then I went skip tending. That's working out in the shaft. You load the measuring pocket with ore, and then the skip would come, and you open the door and load the skip. And you ring the bell, and the hoist man will hoist the dirt up.
Can you define a skip for me?
Well, a skip is a second cousin of the cage, you might say. It's 6 feet square, roughly 20 feet long, and it carries 12 tons. Sometimes you'd open the door and the dirt wouldn't go down, and you tried blowing it, and it wouldn't go. Then you went down in the shaft and you stood on top of the skip and you poked the dirt, and the dirt came down and filled the skip. Then you rang three slow bells, whoever was on top, and the skip would come up high enough so the man that was standing on the top could get out the door and come back up.
So was this, the skip was the actual hoisting device to get the ore up?
That was the hoisting device, yeah.
One of the things I guess I realized I didn't ask you is, what color was everything underground? What, as you looked around, what did you see when you were underground?
Generally black. Mostly everything was black. Dark gray. You had lights on them, but they weren't that good.
And even the color of the ore body itself was black?
No, that was reddish. The ore body itself.
What about all the equipment? obviously mostly made of metal, but was it mostly reddish color too from the ore?
Yes, they were generally reddish from the ore. Sometimes when they were hung a lot of rock, then it changed to grayish.
And then I suppose most of the men were about that color too, huh?
Right. You got pretty dirty sometimes.
All right. Now, when you were a skip tender, it was your job then to make sure that the ore got from what into the skip?
They call it a trench. A big long drift, and the track was right beside it. The cars had come out, and they had a little wheel on the side of the car, and that would go on the camelback, they call it. That was a like a big hump on the side of the track. Part of the car going under this to hold it down, and then the other part with the wheel, the fifth wheel, would go over this camelback, dump the car and go down the other side and close. When you ran roughly 10 cars through, then you'd pull them back, and then the motor man would take his motor and take them inside again, load them again.
So then the little camelback spot on the track was located exactly next to the skip, and it would dump everything into the skip?
No, it would dump it into the trench, and then we'd scrape it into the measuring pocket so that when the skip came down, we'd open the door. It was air-operated, big cylinder. It opened the door, and the dirt would fall down in the skip. We shut the door and give the engineer the signal to hoist it to surface.
So I'm trying to get a little feel for the proximity of each thing to the other. I know a lot of this is documented elsewhere, but just so I understand it, the measuring pocket would have been like something that had a slant to it, and then a door that would lift at the bottom.
Yes, you got right there. It is slanted on two sides. The other two sides were straight, and it was a pretty good slant. The oil went out good most of the time.
And so then the measuring pocket would hold the same volume of ore as
12 tons.
And then was it a trap door that would lift?
It was on the side, more or less. You could call it a trap door, but it was on the side and it lift up.
Kind of like a guillotine going up?
Right. And it'd go up and the dirt would go down most of the time. And when the pocket was empty, you'd shut the door again and fill it up again with a scraper.
Now, on those occasions when the ore would get stuck in the measuring pocket, then what would you have to do?
Well, we try to bar it down from up on top. Either bar it or use a water pipe. But sometimes even that failed. Then we'd have to go down and stand on top of the skip and bar it from down there.
So what's a water pipe?
A pipe that you can put water through. It's
high pressure?
Yes, high pressure. It's about 60 pounds, I'd say.
So sometimes then that force, that water under pressure, would be enough to knock the rock loose?
Yes, it would wash the dirt around the rocks, and then they'd start moving, and they'd go down.
So then I think I understand this a little bit better now. Then if that still didn't work, then was there like a ladder of some sort that you would go down and stand up on the edge of the skip and work from below with the bar to push, to prod, and make the ore come out of the measuring pocket?
Well, we'd go on the skip side of the landing, and between the skip and the cage, there's a ladder road. It's roughly 4 feet wide. You got ladders you go down. Then we'd have to go down maybe 20 feet, open a little trap door and go in and stand on top of the skip and bar it down.
Okay, I think I understand that pretty clearly now. And then the skip and the cage were pretty much side by side in the shaft?
They were separated by roughly 4 feet by the ladder road.
And then were did the skips ever operate at the same time that the men were going up and down in the cage?
No, generally they stop the skip when they're hoisting them in.
Okay, we talked about how the skip and the cage went up side by side with a ladder out in between. Was there any other difference between the way that the two things were set up?
Well, the skip road was all sheeted in and ironed. Between the sets, there was iron all the way to the surface. So there was no chance of dirt going from the skip over into the cage road.
All right. Is there anything else about... So we went from being a miner to... what was that job called? A skip operator?
Skip tender.
Skip tender. How long did you do that, approximately?
Approximately a couple of years. Then one day they were sinking shaft from 6.5 level down, I'd say. And they were working down there, and they had a small hoist on the side of the shaft in a little drip, but they'd hoist the rock up from the bottom of the shaft, load it in a pocket, and then they'd bring their big skip down and load that and hoist it up. But the engineer they had was sick or something, so they took me down there and said, here's a job for you for a few days. Well, that lasted roughly, I'd say, 4 months. Then they needed an engineer up in the big engine house, and then I went up in the big engine house. So.
Can you describe to me what the engineer's job is?
The engineer's job is to, if you're on the skip hoist, you get the signal from the skip fender to hoist or lower the skip, whether it's dirt or oil or rock, rather. You hoist it up and then you dump it. Spot the other one and get answering signals.
Now, the first engine house that you were in, I'm presuming it was an engine house.
Yeah.
Where was that? Was that underground?
Yes, that was underground. It was a small hoist. It wasn't a big one like up on the surface. But we hoisted the dirt that they were breaking in the bottom of the shaft, brought it up and hoisted it to surface from there then.
So there was a separate hoist set up when they were sinking shaft?
Yes, that was a separate hoist.
Now, I'm getting the impression that there was more than one skip in the shaft. How many skips were there altogether?
There were two skips. One's counterbalancing the other.
Then how many skip loads an hour, or how many skip loads a shift would there have been?
Oh, roughly 100 skips a shift.
Now, you did the you ran the engine underground for about 4 months, you said.
Yes.
Any idea what the size of that engine would be?
That was about a 500 horsepower electric motor on that one.
And how did you operate it? Was it levers or buttons, or how did that work?
A bunch of levers. One for the brake, and one for going down, and one for coming up.
And how did you tell where in the shaft the actual skip was?
Well, we had a mark on our drum to tell you where you were, roughly. And then you went by so many revolutions when we were in the small engine house down below.
So the drum had cable wrapped around it that was connected to the skip?
Yes. Then the big engine house, of course, we had a big dial, like a clock face. And that would tell us, wherever the pointer was, that where it was in the shaft.
Now, was there any kind of a communication system of where the skip was in the shaft and a lookout below type of a thing that you would tell people?
No, not really, because there shouldn't be anybody in the shaft when we were hoisting dirt. And just the operator down below, the skip tender, he's the only one that had control down on the bottom end, you might say.
We're going to stop here and stop tape, change tape.